We are returning this morning after a one-week break for Shavuot. We are now returning to our study of the book of Isaiah. And we are beginning this morning with chapter 11, verse 1. If you will remember, we had God's proclamation through Isaiah in chapter 10 of the great judgment that was coming, not only against Israel, but against those who brought the judgment against Israel, because they went way beyond the boundary. It started off really with judgment upon Israel, when he talked about that judgment based upon their sins of idolatry, all the sins, the beginning of Isaiah, their injustice, their corruption, and all the rest. In fact, in Isaiah chapter 9, verse 10, it gives some reference. The bricks have fallen down, but we will rebuild with smooth stones. The sycamores have been cut down, but we will replace them with cedars. It was the arrogance of the people that even though it was cut down, they would rebuild even better, and God was saying that was not going to be. So after the great proclamation of judgment upon Israel and upon those who brought the judgment upon Israel, there have been these little hints of something else that was going to happen, something wonderful. And in chapter 11, we will return to that theme of this wonderful thing that was going to happen. Chapter 11 of Isaiah, starting in verse 1. Then a shoot will spring from the stem of Jesse, and a branch from his roots will bear fruit. Now it's interesting that he did not say that it was a shoot from the stem of David. And I puzzled over this week to try to come up with some understanding of why he would make mention of the root of Jesse rather than the root which was David. I think it's tied up in a couple of different things. For one thing, he is speaking to a disobedient and fallen house of David, that the kings who followed after David were not, in general, those who followed after God, although there were exceptions. There were godly kings in the line of David who did serve God, but as a whole, the line of David was nothing very much to brag about. I think another point is that it is emphasizing the total destruction of the royal house of Israel, that it has taken it all the way back beyond David to its very roots, even before it was known as king. It is a total obliteration of the house of David. I don't know if you've ever had a tree cut down in your backyard. We've had it cut down in our old house. And a strange thing happens after a while, is that after a while, it doesn't even look like a tree is there. After a while, a root will wake up and a little shoot will come up around where that tree used to be. That where the tree is gone, now out of its root, if the root is healthy, comes the shoot. And I think God is hearkening back here to the healthy root. I think it's also a picture that it's not only the root which was Jesse, but also the root which sustained Jesse, and really the root which chose Jesse's son in order to be king, rather God's working in the life of Jesse and the life of his children. So a shoot will spring forth from the stem of Jesse, and a branch from his roots will bear fruit. Just when you think the tree is gone, you look down, and there is a little tiny shoot. Around the beginning of the 20th century, we imported some chestnut trees from China and planted them in New York City. And unbeknownst to anyone, they carried a particular fungus that the Chinese chestnuts were resistant to, but the American chestnuts had no resistance to whatsoever. So as a result, every chestnut tree with the exception of maybe a dozen east of the Mississippi, was dead within 30 years. The chestnut tree used to be the king of the forest, but now you cannot find chestnut trees anymore east of the Mississippi because they're all dead. But the only way chestnuts remained is from the rootstock of trees. Occasionally you would get a shoot from out of it, that although the tree itself was obliterated, there still would come a small shoot coming out of it. Now, in our backyard, the neighbors looked at me kind of funny, because I like to let grow what was, I call them God-planted trees, but they were God used the instrument of squirrels to plant trees. And so these things are just spring up. And when they're about this high, about 4 or 5 inches high, they would get stepped on, they would get mowed over, all sorts of things would happen, and I'd say, oh, there goes that tree. But so long as the tree, the little tiny tree, the baby tree, had healthy roots, next year, poink, up would come another shoot. I have some testimonies to resurrection in that backyard that have come back a couple of, two or three times, that are now about waist high, and they're no longer going to be mowed down, and there are other trees that are far greater than waist high, although I don't think I mowed them down that much. But so long as the root was healthy, the tree survived. I had other trees that I refrained from mowing down, but they just spontaneously died because the root was not healthy. So long as there is a good, solid root, resurrection is possible. Resurrection is possible. It appears to be resurrection. I mention that because one of our songs this morning is talking about God's working in our life. So long as our root is strong, in the book of Proverbs it says that though a righteous man falls 7 times, he'll get up again. And that is the pattern of the righteous, and that is the pattern of God's plan. Oftentimes it happens when things are the most hopeless, when things look like there is no way possible that God is going to get this to work. Now, I'm not talking about when we ourselves wander into sin and we're enduring the consequences. I'm talking about when we are focused on the Lord and doing our very best, and the piano falls on us, or the trapdoor opens in the sidewalk, and all of a sudden we find ourselves flat on our back saying, what just happened? What just happened there? I thought it was just fine. It was like lightning out of a clear sky, or a tornado out of a clearless day, or a clear sky with not a cloud in sight. All of a sudden, boom, there you are, sitting in the middle of the wreckage. And even in the midst of that, God can bring forth fruit. Now, in particular, this figure of the trees being cut down is a figure that has been all through the last few sections, talking about God's total judgment, that he was to obliterate the disobedient and arrogant people, that he was going to discipline the southern kingdom, but yet bring restoration. So we get to this point, and we have that same picture that we had last time of what used to be a verdant forest now is just this dusty sea of stumps. And you think, man, that's dead. That's never coming back. And you look and say, what's that? Oh, there's a leaf there. There's a leaf there. So it's talking about a shoot, a stem, a branch, but a very particular branch that doesn't just stop being this 4-inch-high little thing, but it says that this little sprig, this little shoot, will grow up and it will be a mighty branch and will bear much fruit. Verse 2, the Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and strength, the Spirit of knowledge, and the fear of the Lord. Well, now we get a sense that God's not just talking about any branch here, is he? He is talking about a particular branch out of the line of Jesse at a point when that line looked like it was extinguished, that was going to not only revive that line, but be something that was truly and absolutely remarkable. Well, if you're believers and you've been around for a while, you understand who we're talking about. We're talking about Yeshua himself, that at the time he was born, the house of David had sunk so low that Yeshua's father was working as a carpenter. They did not even have the money necessary when it came for the sacrifices in the temple. You read about the sacrifices they took for the redemption of the birth of Yeshua. They were not sacrifices that rich people took. They were sacrifices that were devoted to those who were the poorest in the land. And so here we have the house of David that in the time of Isaiah was still proud and arrogant and still sitting upon the throne of the southern kingdom. And Yeshua's time had gone underground. And with good reason. The one who was so-called king over Israel, Herod, was not of the line of David. As a matter of fact, he was not even an ethnic Jew. He was an ethnic Idumean, or a descendant of Edom. And he had some association with the Maccabees and their line through marriage, but he himself was not of Jewish descent. And anyone who had any claims to the king of Israel, any credible claims to the throne of Israel, and had any chance of acting on those claims, were in great danger. The house of David was not active in the political life of that land, but rather was very much underground, like a tree that had been cut down to its stump. And all that was left was its roots, and out of those roots came the shoot. And upon him it said, the Spirit of the Lord will rest upon him. Well, this was literally fulfilled, wasn't it? At the time of his baptism, it is reported in all the Gospels that the Spirit of the Lord, in the form of a dove, rested upon him as a witness to John the Baptist, and was part of John the Baptist's preaching about Yeshua, that this was not just something that was figurative or symbolic, but rather it was something that was very literal. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him. And then it gives further characteristics of this. Remember, the ancient writings did not have a table of content, it didn't have bold type, it didn't have chapter headings and all the rest of it, it didn't have an index and all the rest of it. So rather what you would do is that you would announce the topic and then go into detail, then you go into more detail, then you go into even more detail. So especially prophecy, you have this spiral where you keep going through the same stuff, but in greater and greater detail. Greater and greater detail. The Spirit of the Lord rests upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and strength, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. Three pairs of attributes. One commentator put it as intellectual attributes, practical attributes, and attributes in terms of his spiritual life. The first set, wisdom and understanding, this was someone that knew how to live and how others ought to live and how he himself ought to conduct himself. People who look at Yeshua's writings, even if they do not acknowledge who he is, still will acknowledge that in his writings there is great wisdom, and in his principles there is great understanding. And that there are many people who try to live lives based on the teaching of Yeshua without living lives that are brought to life by Yeshua with varying degrees of success. Oftentimes, not very great success. But he is known for wisdom and understanding. Counsel and strength. In a sense, this harkens back to the names that were given back in chapter 9 for his wonderful counselor. This was someone who was known for counsel, but needing no counsel. I can think of no time when Yeshua looked to his disciples for advice. Not because he was too proud to, he didn't need to. There was no time at which he was in a jam that he needed to ask for advice to get out of it. And strength, no one can accuse him of being weak. Meek and subdued, power under control, yes. Weak, never. When he cast out demons with the word, when he rose, he caused the dead to rise on command, where there was no one who came to him sick, desiring healing, that went away still sick because he was unable to heal them. He healed the blind, the lame, any disease that you can imagine, even leprosy, that came to him for healing. He walked away, that person walked away healed. He was not affected by the elements. In the midst of great storm, he got up in the middle of the boat and he said, "Quiet," like you quiet a room full of disobedient children. And the storm quieted. He was not affected by certain physical laws when he desired to. He could walk on water. At the time after his resurrection, he could pass through walls into locked rooms and out. This was someone who was strong, someone who was powerful. Oftentimes, in our common culture, in American standard religion, this aspect of Yeshua is not stressed. As people, somebody put it, I don't remember who, I don't remember if it was C.S. Lewis, it might have been, but I don't think it was, described that every time Yeshua is pictured on a portrait, he is pictured akin to a 12-year-old girl with tuberculosis, was the description. As somebody who is so weak and so ready to keel over that it is not someone that you could picture as being strong. Now, modern day, in our modern day, Rod has come around and starting to picture him more as a strong, vibrant individual. But you look back on some of the portraits that were done, some of the art in the 19th century, and see what Yeshua was pictured as. But even nowadays, although one pictures him as being a strong individual, when it comes to understanding his attitudes toward sin, for example, people are all too likely to imagine him as being a pushover rather than to be the manifestation of a mighty God. Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. This is someone who understands how the world works and understands what God's role is in it. And as a result, he is fearful in the sense of being submitted to the will of the Lord in terms of the will of the Godhead in total. Now you look at that, and this is one of the things that we have such a hard time talking through, because once again, our heads don't sort of go there. It's teaching physics to a dog. It's one of these things where we don't have the experience to unravel how you could have God living in the fear of God. It's almost like being scared of your own shadow or something along those lines. But this is summed up in Yeshua's life. When you look particularly in the garden before his great sacrifice, his attitude towards the will of the Father, that in awe and respect to the whole manifestation, the whole Godhead, that he submits himself to great suffering for the will of God, fear of the Lord. Verse 3, and he will delight in the fear of the Lord, and he will not judge by what his eyes see, nor make a decision by what his ears hear. What does this mean? Does it mean that he closes his eyes and shuts his ear and throws a dartboard at a decision? What this means is that he looks beyond appearances in judgment. In other words, he cannot be fooled. He cannot have the wool pulled over his eyes. He cannot be deceived. Even though we might try to deceive ourselves as to our standing before God and what we're doing and why we're doing, Yeshua is completely and totally unfooled by any gimmick that we come up with. We think somehow that God is stupider than we are, and that we can pull tricks on God that we would not pull on our boss at work, or as we were growing up, on our mother or father, they would see through it, or on our teachers, they would see through it, but somehow we think that Yeshua will be fooled and won't see through this, but he will not judge by appearances. Verse 4, but with righteousness he will judge the poor and decide with fairness for the afflicted of the earth, and he will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked. I said we've got a descending spiral going through this in more detail. Verse 3 really is amplifying this idea of the spirit of wisdom and understanding in terms of his focus on the poor in opposition to how the current rulers of Israel were treating the poor. When Isaiah was speaking to them, the current leaders of Israel were exploiting the poor, and what this one who is coming would be someone who would judge beyond external appearances to see the poor as they were, not as poor people, but as people who happen to be poor, right? Which is the distinction that was made by him. And with righteousness he would judge them, not by a spirit of partiality, but rather with a spirit of impartiality, with righteousness. This part about striking the earth with the rod of his mouth, in verse 4, we get into his counsel and strength. His decisions would be fair, and he has the strength to carry it out. You don't believe it, he has both the strength and the will to carry it out. Read through the book of Revelation, or read through the book of Zechariah further on, and you'll see what our Messiah will be like when he returns, and he will surely strike the earth with the rod of his mouth and with the breath of his lips. He will slay the wicked. That the time for grace is now, the time for judgment is coming. Verse 6, and the wolf will dwell with the lamb, and the leopard will lie down with the young goat, and the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little boy will lead them. I guess we can go on to verse 8. And also the cow and the bear will graze, the young will lie down together, and the lion will eat straw like the ox. The nursing child will play by the hole of the cobra, and the weaned child will put his hand on the viper's den. They will not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. I heard this joke that there was a man who visited the Moscow Zoo, and he looked, and there in a cage was a lion and a lamb together. And he was excited because he said, prophecy has been fulfilled. The lion and the lamb are lying down together. So he went to the zookeeper, and he said, how do you do this? How do you get those two to lie down together? And the zookeeper said, it's easy. Every day we put in another lamb. It's not talking about that, but rather it's talking about the order of our world, at least in the mountain around Jerusalem, turned upside down, or we would say right side up. Who would think of a lion eating grass? If you went to the zoo and saw a lion eating grass, you would stop dead in your tracks. You would get your glasses changed. You would get an exam at the psychiatrist because you would think something terribly was wrong. It's not the natural order of things. People said that, Yeshua came back, you just didn't notice it. They're nuts. They're the ones who are just need to see someone. You see this in the cult every now and then come up with this weird idea that this was fulfilled, but somehow most of the world missed it. This is not something that you're going to miss. This is going to be a topsy-turvy sort of thing in our mind, that stuff is just going to be different than what we're used to. You don't let kids play around poisonous snakes. Right? That's kind of a given, that you just don't let kids play around poisonous snakes. But here, the idea is that the snakes are not going to be dangerous because the snakes are not going to have the will to attack. Because the peace of God that rests upon this world, and particularly here, is talking about the holy mountain of God around Jerusalem, that peace of God is going to be so powerful in that environment that even things in the animal kingdom will act differently and that peace will even extend to the animal kingdom. Verse 10, then in that day, the nations will resort to the root of Jesse, who will stand as a signal for the peoples, and his resting place will be glorious. This is something that is going way beyond the borders of Israel. In one sense, we talked a little bit here about God's holy mountain and the land of Israel, but this which is going on, this root of Jesse, the shoot out of Jesse, is something that's going to have impact way beyond the nation of Israel, into the whole world. And we see a partial fulfillment today, don't we? We see nations all around the world resorting to that root of Jesse, even nowadays. The Yeshua is preached in places that his followers never even heard of. In fact, people in just a generation or two ago in our country never heard of these places in the far corners of the earth, places that are mountains and jungles and deserts and places in the midst of oceans that, in the midst of it, that here the people in that very nation are resorting to that root of Jesse, standing as a signal for the peoples, or a banner, or a rallying point for the people. Is there a nation on the earth that at least doesn't have some people in it that doesn't know of him? So we see a partial fulfillment then, but the total fulfillment is coming in this day with the wolf laying down with the lamb and all the rest of it, when he really does visibly establish his reign in Jerusalem. So you come to the bottom of this and you ask yourself again, so what? I guess the so what here is this is a hedge against American standard religion. This idea that Yeshua is just like anybody else, just like these other gods of other nations, just like these other prophets, just like these other teachers. It goes on and on and on and on and on. He's not like that at all. He was something remarkable. Now, some Jewish commentators have a little tap dance here, trying to make this branch seem like somebody else, but in the Haftorah reading today, in Zechariah chapter 3, we came across this branch again, so it was certainly not someone before Zechariah's time, but somebody after Zechariah's time. And Zechariah was after the house of David was reigning as king, so this is somebody completely different than one of the kings during the time of Isaiah. So if somebody comes up to you, if you would try to tell them about this root of Jesse from Isaiah, and they'll say, that was Hezekiah, or this was Josiah, or they pick another king of Israel, you just shake your head and say, no, it cannot be. It is pointing forward to Yeshua, who as that sprout out of Jesse, out of the root of Jesse, grows up into this mighty tree that is the standard for all the peoples, including Israel, to flock to. So it speaks to us of the nature of who it is that we serve and the heritage to which we are looking forward to, because the plan of God, the plan of Yeshua, is not finished yet. He is coming back, and all the rest of this will be fulfilled, just as the first part of this was fulfilled. And we should wait in joyful expectation for that very day. Let's close in prayer. Dearest God and Father, I thank you for this ray of hope in the midst of this hopeless time in the life of Israel. I thank you for all the rays of hope you send into our lives at times when our situation seems the most hopeless. I thank you for the great promise that was made, and I thank you that he is already a standard to which many nations, including ours, can rally. And rallying to that standard, we rally to you, or that rally to the great expectation of that coming kingdom and so order and direct our lives and our affections towards that root, that shoot of Jesse, that Messiah, that King, that righteous, holy, and powerful Redeemer, Yeshua, our Messiah. Amen.